Hello, this is Gidon Rothstein, and this is Perek Hey of Melachim Bet, another well-known Perek because it appears as a haftarah, as one of the haftarot that we read during the year. The Pasuk Aleph says, "Ven Aman sar tzeva melech Aram haya ish gadol lifnei Adonav unesufanim kivo natan Hashem tshuva la'Aram v'ish haya gibor chayel mitzora." We are introduced to Naaman, who is an important warrior to his master, to the king of the king of Aram, and he was well countenanced with him. He was beheld by him well, meaning the king of Aram likes him a lot, is willing to do much for him, as we'll see that he'll do much for him. And he was a gibor chayil, and he had been the source, the pasuk says, of tshuva le'Aram. So Rashi and Radak quote the tradition of Chazal that says that. Naaman sort of fell into this status. He is the one who was shooting his arrow without knowing who he was shooting at, and shot Achav and killed Achav. So that is an interesting concept of Vonatan Hashem Tshuva L'Aram. Is that's exactly what happened? Right? Hashem had decided that Achav should die in this war, and whoever it was shooting, not realizing, because Achav had dressed himself up to hide, to disguise himself, and he hits Achav, and then he becomes this important person in Aram, and he becomes important to the king, and the king likes him, and all ensues from that. Just by the way, stressing to us and reminding us that things like position and success are not always about who we are or what we do. They might be about just other factors that HaKadosh Baruch Hu chooses to bring into play. And he's Gibor Chayil, but he's a Mitzora. He's got Tzarat, and this is obviously why this is the Haftarah for Parashat Tazria in the Torah. So, Pasuk Bet. V'aram yitzu gidudim v'yishbu me'eret Yisrael na'ara ktana v'ti lifnei eshet Naaman. So remember, we've seen that at this time in history, Aram and Yisrael are having these continuing wars. So in one of those, they send out a raiding party that has enough people, and it's called a gedud, a legion or a battalion. And they take a captive, a young girl, from so Nara Ktana, the Mefarshim, the Radak points out that it says Nara and Ktana. It says in Chazal say it too. It says Nara and Ktana because it's reminding us that there's such a thing as a Nara who's not a Ktana. That the word Na'ar doesn't mean, the word Na'ar doesn't mean boy, and the word Nara doesn't mean little girl. It means other certain things in different contexts. So a Na'ar can often be a servant. And here a Nara Ktana is a young girl. And Vatihilifne Eshet Naaman, and she gets taken as the servant for the wife of Naaman. Matomrel Givirta, Achale Adoni Lifne Hanavia Shebeshamron. She says to her mistress, he should go and daven in front of, or he should bring his prayers to, the prophet in Shomron, meaning Elisha. Az Yasofato Mitzarato, because Elisha can obviously heal him of his tzarat. So she's giving her mistress an idea. Now, it's possible she's doing this to curry favor with her mistress. She figures that if she's the source of healing for Naaman, they will treat her well. Who knows, maybe even they will release her, or whatever other calculations she might have had. So one way to read this is just to say, this is the girl being opportunistic to some extent, trying to find an opportunity to succeed and to get ahead and to do well. And that's why she's speaking this way to Naaman's wife. I think it's also possible, however, that she does it because she feels bad for Naaman and she wants to help him out. Now, in that circumstance, if that's really what's going on, then part of what's worth noticing, and this is something that in America we don't understand nearly as much because we don't live in a society, for very good reasons, but we don't live in a society where things like slavery actually still exist. But it's, I think, worth noticing that this girl doesn't seem to hate Naaman and his family so much that she's unwilling to share with him ideas for how he could get better. Meaning they wouldn't have punished her if she hadn't told them this. They don't know that she knows this. So her decision or her choice to share this information with them, I think, bespeaks some goodwill between them. And that just goes to show that slavery or being a captive was not a wholly negative experience in all ways. It wasn't a great experience. I'm not recommending it. I'm not saying that, oh, there was nothing wrong with it. It was certainly a sad experience and a painful experience, and it meant separation from your family and your society and the people you grew up with and the people you know, and all of those things should not be minimized. But on the other hand, it doesn't leave her with a lasting bitterness that gets in the way of her noticing the Aman's pain and suggesting that she has a way for him to get healed. So Vayavova Yidla Dunav Lemor, so he takes this advice and he says to his master, meaning the king of Aram, Kazir Bechazod Ibrahim Aram, this is what the girl said, Asher Me'eretz Yisrael, who comes from this land. So I captured this girl in a war, and this is what she's telling me. So what can we do about this? Vayomer Melech Aram Leich Bo Ve'esh Lechasefer Al Melech Yisrael. He says, so come, and you'll go to him, and I'll send with you a letter. A book, a letter to the king of Israel. He brings a gift, right? A bunch of silver, a bunch of gold, and changes of clothing, meaning fancy clothing, for a gift for either for Melech Israel or for the Navi. He brings the letter from the king of Aram, and the letter says, he says, when you get this letter, it means it's coming to you with my servant Naaman, and please do me the favor of asafto mitzarato, which means heal him from his tzarat. Rashi suggests that the reason it says heal him mitzarat is because when he had the tzarat, people would kick you out of the house. So va'asafto mitzarato means you'll gather him into the house, you'll take him into the house. He'll be gathered back into society, which suggests that when the Torah requires sending a mitzora michutz lamachane, outside the machane, and that doesn't mean the kind of exclusion that is implied here. It means out of one of the machanot of Yerushalayim or of the Beit HaMikdash, or out of a much more narrow machane. But in Naaman's time, then it was assumed by everybody that that's what you did when you had tzarat. You went out of human society. You had tzarat, so they kick you out of human society. So, basato mitzarato, you'll heal him and bring him back into society. V'hikikril Melech Yisrael at ha-sefer, v'yikra b'gadav. When Melech Yisrael reads the letter, he tears his clothing. V'yomer ha-elokim ani lamitu l'hachayot. Am I a god? Am I God to bring to life and to kill and to bring to life? Because he's sending to me, I should heal Naaman from his tzarat. Ki ach du na ru'u. So he says to those around him, look and see, ki mitanehuli. He's just looking for an excuse to destroy me or to fight with me or to have a problem with me. Radak assumes that he was too embarrassed to go in front of Elisha because they had such bad interactions, and he was still worshiping idols, even though Elisha had repeatedly asked him not to worship idols, or suggested to him, or berated him, or whatever it is that Elisha does to try to get him not to worship idols, and he was too embarrassed to go in front of Elisha under these circumstances. The problem with that reading is that then you have to say that he's tearing his clothing in distress, and he's so unwilling to go in front of Elisha, he assumes that Melech Aram wouldn't have thought of Elisha. I mean, he's saying he's looking for an excuse to destroy me. Maybe he heard about Elisha and has nothing to do with your personal relationship. So I wonder whether it's not plausibly true, and Elisha's reaction, it seems to me, will support this idea, that the king of Israel, Yehoram, at the time, the king of Israel is so caught up in his idol worship and caught up in his understanding of the world that even though Elisha repeatedly talks to them about Hashem and Hashem having power and this and this and this, he doesn't live in that world, and it just doesn't penetrate for Yehoram, and therefore when he gets his letter, his honest reaction is, kill Tzarat? That's crazy stuff, and after all, it is going to be a miracle, and therefore it's not part of the ordinary ammunition of a Navi to heal Tzarat. It's not like a Navi generally heals Tzarat. Elisha is going to step in here to heal Tzarat to prove that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has power. But that's not something that you would necessarily assume, which shows that part of the problem with this time period was that people only thought prophets could do whatever prophets could do. But when a new need came along, so he couldn't even think that it would be possible that a prophet could do it, because prophets have whatever powers they have. They have their powers. And if this is not one of their well-enumerated powers, well-known powers, then there's no reason they can do it. So that's a mistake that's part of that goes to the root of the problem and the challenge that Elisha faced in trying to convince people about what it means to be a Navi. So in this case, he steps in. When he hears of the tearing of the clothing, he sends a message to the king saying, why do you tear your clothing? Let him come to me, and he'll know that there's a prophet in Israel. So we've seen that theme, that phrasing, or variations on it before. That part of the whole challenge of this time was to let people know Ki Yesh Nevi B'Yisrael, and to make them live Ki Yesh Nevi B'Yisrael, make it alive for them, make it a reality for them. So let them come to me, I will take care of it, and then they'll know that we have real Nevi, meaning people who really connect to God. So he comes with his horses and his chariots and his power, and he comes to the opening of Elisha's door. He sends him a messenger saying, he says, go wash 7 times in the Jordan, and your blood and your skin will come back like it once was, and you'll be tahar. So Naaman doesn't like this, because Naaman expected that what do prophets do? So prophets make big waving of the hands, big ceremonies, and that's not what he's doing here. As he's going to say, Naaman has the self-awareness to say this. He says, I assumed he would come out to me, and he would cry out to Hashem, and he would wave his hand over the place, he would do magic, he would do it in that way. So that's what he's expecting, and that presumably precisely why Elisha did not do it that way. Elisha says, yeah, go wash in the Jordan. And you see, in Pasuk Yud Bet, Naaman is catching that point. Halo tov, amanau farparna, wrote Damascus. We've got rivers in Damascus. They're much bigger and better. Mikol mimei Yisrael, from any water that the Jews have, that the Israel has, halarachatz behem at the heart. Maybe I could I really wash in them and get the Vayifin vayifin vayifin. So he's furious. And he's walking away in fury. Because this didn't meet his expectation. A key point very often in our ability to recognize the truth in life. If it doesn't meet our expectations, how open are we to the possibility that it may nonetheless be true? So in this case, Naaman would appear to be unready to have that recognition. So he's going off in anger, he's ready to just be furious at the idea that Elisha could have healed him. His servants, his slaves, see the flaw in his logic. He told you to do some hard thing, go miles or climb mountains, you would have done it. And here it tells you, just do a simple thing. Just try it. See what will you lose? Not so hard. And you would have done something hard. So he does. He does exactly what Elisha says. So his skin is healed from the mitzarat that we obviously expected. But the Pasuk actually describes it a little bit better. It becomes like a young boy's again. It comes is refreshed even. So now he realizes. So one of the key, I don't know, embarrassing things about Naaman is that he's going to really realize it, right? He's going to really learn his lesson. He comes back and he says, now I know that there is no God in the whole land except for among the Jewish people. Now take a bracha from your servant. So the Pasuk doesn't, and Chazal don't discuss, they assumed it, that obviously you understand these things, but they don't discuss the challenge of why it is that Naaman realizes it fully and accepts it fully, and all these generations of Jews who saw miracles from Hashem were not able to draw that lesson, were not able to come to that conclusion and to understand what it was that Hashem, the point that Hashem was trying to make all this time, right? All the other, all the generations of Jews that Elisha has been dealing with, so they have seen these miracles, similar miracles, functionally similar miracles, and yet they don't come to realize that there is no God in the land other than HaKadosh Baruch Hu, other than Hashem. Not an easy question. I wonder whether it's because Naaman really understood paganism, and he knew that in paganism you believed in all these various gods, and in those various gods, the assumption was that different gods have different powers. And yet here along comes Elisha, I believe, with a miracle that was outside the purview of what any of the common gods were able to do. meaning there was no God whose power it was to heal Tzaraat. Tzaraat was just the bane of existence, and you couldn't get away from it. So when Elisha comes and heals that, and he does it in a way that's obviously lacking in flash or panache or magic, so that's when he knows it's just a function of HaKadosh Baruch Hu controlling nature. And there is no such thing as a healing that doesn't happen with it happens so calmly that's not directly from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what I think is going on, but it's not clear. So he comes back and he says, so let me give you a bracha. Kachna bracha meit avdecha. Let me give you, and a bracha here means a gift. That's an interesting thing, that a bracha means a gift. So when we colloquially use bracha in terms of the things that we use it for, it's plausible to argue that what we mean is it's some kind of a gift to the source of the bracha. Not to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's a whole different kind of a bracha. But if I give a bracha to somebody, I'm trying to help give them something good and valuable in their lives. So Elisha says, Vayomer, Chai Hashem Asher Amanti Levanav Yimekach. He swears in the name of God that I won't take it. And the Gemara in the Sifrei in Devarim says, from here, one of the sources, that this shows you're supposed to take oaths to train yourself not to do certain things, suggesting that Elisha very much would have liked to have taken a gift. We have no reason to think that Elisha was wealthy and was just had no problems with finances whatsoever. We're not told what his finances are. So this idea in the Sifrei that you're supposed to take oaths to train yourself to do the right thing would suggest that, in fact, he wasn't wealthy. He did have interest in the financial benefits here, and to avoid falling prey to that, it was right to not take it. It was right not to take it because that proves to Naaman, that drives the point home to Naaman, that this wasn't about money and that it was disinterested in involvement with Hashem. So the importance of that point is that Elisha can't therefore take money because that will ruin the point. So in those terms, Elisha takes an oath to stop himself. So he tries to get him to take it, and Elisha manages to say no. He says, okay, and now please, if you're not going to take a gift from me, give me perhaps a load of dirt, the amount of dirt that two donkeys can hold in a barrel behind them, in a wheelbarrow, that they can load up, or that they can load on themselves with a mule team's load of dirt. I'm not going to sacrifice any more to other gods. Ki'im laHashem. I'm only going to sacrifice to Hashem. So he's looking for the dirt to apparently make a mizbeach. So the question of Bamot and why he's not told, well, you can't do that because you have to only bring your sacrifices to Hashem in Yerushalayim, that's not raised by Elisha. So that could be a whole discussion that you could have about non-Jews and whether they're obligated in that prohibition or not. But I guess that's what he says. I'm only going to do it to Hashem. And then in Pasuk Yitzchak says, "L'davar hazeh yislach Hashem la'avdecha bevor Adoni beit rimon lishtaravot shama v'hu nishan al yadi." He says, but Hashem has to forgive me for this. When I go with my master, the king of Aram, to beit rimon, and he's going to bow down there, and he's going to lean on my hands, so v'shtaraveti beit rimon, I have to bow down with him, otherwise I'll be in trouble. He'll kill me. V'shtaravayati beit rimon yislach Hashem. He says, so when I bow down in Beit Rimon and I don't just tell my master that I don't believe in Beit Rimon anymore and that I only believe in God, so Hashem has to forgive me for that. Please. I mean, he's asking for permission, or he's asking for God's forbearance when it comes to this. So the Gemara in Avodah Zarah and Sanhedrin, when Ayin Dalet Amud Aleph actually says that this might be a source to suggest that non-Jews are not obligated in Ed Kiddush Hashem. They said, because he asked this, and if there's a mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem, meaning Kiddush Hashem means when it comes to certain mitzvahs that you have to be killed rather than transgress them, and Elisha says to him, no, it's okay. Right? Elisha says to him in the next pasuk, meaning it's okay. So he goes away a certain distance, and then we'll get to the next part of the story. So the Gemara's answer is that no, maybe not. Maybe in the case of Naaman, that was going to be in private, And the question of Kiddush Hashem is when it's in some kind of a public circumstance, when there are Jews around, whatever the circumstances of Kiddush Hashem have to be, there usually, it's that there have to be 10 Jews watching. And Kiddush Hashem is usually conceived of as being something related to the impression we make, in terms, in front of worshippers of God, in terms, in front of Jews. So, if that's true, so that's what the Gemara suggests. And the Gemara says, no, maybe that was in private, because after all, he only goes to Beit Rimon with his master. So there's a whole question about this. So this pasuk is the source for that question. Is it that non-Jews too are required or obligated around these mitzvos to make the point of Hashem's rule and their belief in Hashem's rule, right? That's the point of our mitzvah Kiddush Hashem, that we have to say, no, my service of God counts more for me, or is more important to me, or however you want to say it, but is more significant to me, is significant enough to me that I'm willing to forgo my life to avoid transgressing this. So that's a question that's open in the Gemara there. Vayomer Gehazi pasuk chaf, Vayomer Gehazi nar Elisha ish Elokim, hinei chasach Adoni et Naaman ha'armi hazem yukachem yadom et kol asher hevi. He says, you know, Elisha went crazy. He didn't take any money from Naaman, even though he brought the money, he brought the gifts. Chai Hashem ki imratzti acharav alakachti mitumo. I'll just take a little bit from him. I want to. So, again, I mentioned before that Chazal read Gehazi as being evil even beforehand. In the last parak, when Gehazi fails to put the mishenet properly, or not, or either he fails or something about the miracle fails when it's Gehazi doing it, so Chazal assume that that's because Gehazi did it wrong. That Gehazi went around mocking Elisha and showing everybody the staff that Elisha had given him and mocking the possibility that this, that such a thing could work, that there was such a possibility as bring somebody back to life with a staff. So if you read it that way, then Gehazi is already evil, and this is nothing new. But then you wonder, and I do wonder, why is it that Elisha chose Gehazi as his servant, as his misharet, as his attendant to begin with? So I think it's possible to suggest, and again, we've seen that at least in the Chazal's reading, of being Mashbiah at Yitzro, so even in Chazal's reading, it would seem like there was a big temptation here to take this money. So if that's true, I think we can cut Gehazi at least a little bit of slack in saying that that he yielded to a temptation. Now, that's not right. It's not appropriate to yield to temptation, but it's more understandable than just than the way Chazal have it. He sort of is the epitome of evil, and I think there's room to read Gehazi slightly more charitably than that. At least at this point. However, interestingly, there's a Masechet Avot de Rabbi Natan, there's a Mishnah in Avot Rabbi Natan, or a Braita, which says, Asaran nitnabu v'lo yadu mat nitnabu. 10, and there's a whole list of them, but they prophesied in a way and they didn't know what they were prophesying. And it gives Gehazi here as an example of that, because you read the word me'uma as muma, meaning a mum, then Gehazi is being prophetic without realizing it. He is announcing that he's going to go to Naaman and he's going to end up walking away with a mum, with a blemish on him. So that's a sort of interesting twist to think about. When do we say things and we don't fully realize what it is that we're saying? So that's something that's sort of going on here under the radar, or under the surface. In any case, Vayidov Gehazi acharei Naaman in pasuk chaf aleph, he runs after Naaman. Vayiren Naaman rats acharav, so Naaman sees somebody running after him. Vayipol me'al merakava lekratov, v'yomer shalom, and he turns around, he falls out, he wants to make sure is everything okay. So Gehazi says, v'yomer shalom, adoni shalachan anymore. He says the name of Elisha because he knows that he himself would not merit or would not get Naaman to give him some kind of a big gift, and that's the point here. He wants to get a gift from Naaman. So he says, my master sent me after you. He now tells him, now he knows you have to follow the lie, right? Gehazi is a careful guy. He knows that he can't pass along any lie in the name of Elisha, because Naaman's gotten to know Elisha a little bit. And he knows that Elisha is not the sort to be swayed by personal financial situations. So what he says is that that's not what happened. What he says is that two boys came from Ephraim and they're in need of stuff. He doesn't ask for everything that Naaman has. He says, give them a talent of silver, give them a certain amount of silver, and two changes of clothing, of rich clothing. So Vayomer Naaman, Hoel Kach Kikaraim. So Naaman says, great, take two of them. Right? That meaning Naaman's happy to give the money. Naaman, from Naaman's perspective, the giving the money doesn't do anything. He thinks it's assumed that when you do a miracle like that, you should do two. So, just an interesting thing about what's going on here, because Gehazi is going to get mitzarat by the end of this discussion. So the Gemara in Erchin thinks that, or mentions that the tzarat comes, it says tzarat comes from a bunch of things. Lashon Hara, you get tzarat for telling, for slandering people, for murder. This is for Shvuat Shav, for producing false oaths. And it gives Gehazi as an example. And the question, and then it gives Gehazi as an example, and it says, that he's saying Ho'el as a Lashon of Shavua of an oath. It's an unnecessary oath. Take two. And then Elisha is going to curse him. The Tzarat Naaman should go on him. So the Gemara seems to be saying that what Gehazi's fault here wasn't that he himself made a false oath or an unnecessary oath, Shavua Shav, a meaningless oath. It was that he caused it Naaman, and that's why he gets the Tzarat of Naaman. On the other hand, Avos Dori Nosson mentions that they think that Gehazi got the tzarat for telling Lashon Hara about Elisha. So what Gehazi did wrong is unclear, and the relevance of this incident with Naaman right now is a possibility in the Gemara in Erechin. So he insists, Vayifrotz bo, Vayatzer kikraim kesef b'shnei charitim, and he puts these two talents of silver in two pouches, and he gives and they carry it before Gehazi. So they come to a hidden place. And he hides in his house because he doesn't want Elisha to know. And he sends the people on their way, and he thanks them, and we have a conclusion of this incident. You wonder, or I wonder at least, about Gehazi and his assuming that Elisha wouldn't find out about this. Right? You have to think that it means that his understanding of the level of prophecy that Elisha had was that it came and it went. So we have seen that there are occasions when Elisha didn't know everything. That happened, for example, with the Shunammite woman when her son died. So apparently Gehazi is assuming that here too. So he comes back to work the next day, right? He comes to stand before his master, which is, I think, kind of surprising. Where are you coming from, Gehazi? This is a classic example of the giving the guilty party a chance to redeem himself by telling the truth. And in this case, as in most cases, the guilty party doesn't realize what's going on, and therefore he continues in his lie, and he says, I didn't go anywhere. He says, you think my heart didn't go with you? You think I didn't see? In Nevuah terms, you didn't think I didn't see when you went and when he fell off the horse? So he doesn't say when you went. When a man fell off his rider, his chariot, to greet you. In other words, it was the reaction of Naaman that Elisha seems to pick up on. It was Naaman being astonished. It's almost as if Elisha had some connection with Naaman by virtue of the miracle he had done for him, and he's monitoring carefully Naaman's state, Naaman's reactions to things, so that when Naaman sees Gehazi coming and is startled, and he gets off his chariot to see what's going on, it's almost as if that was the downfall of Gehazi, because that was the point where Elisha picked up on the emotions, and then understood what had happened and leads to Gehazi's downfall. Because that was what the key was. The key was, and then he says to him, is now the time for money and for clothing? And he goes on to things that weren't even offered, and to olives and olive vineyards and cattle and animals, sheep and cattle, and servants and maids. In other words, if you want to get rich, this time to get rich. This wasn't what this was about. And you've ruined it in some way. And therefore, v'tzarat na'amad idbak becha uzaracha le'olam. So I mentioned before, Chazal suggested it's because he lured Naaman into making a false oath, but it's also, here at least, plausible to see it as because you ruined my miracle, right? You ruined the lesson that I had just about taught Naaman in terms of believing in Hashem and in terms of Torah. Naaman still does believe in Hashem as far as we know, but the depth and the force of the experience was lessened by what Gehazi did. It was given some of a more ordinary cast, and that is what Gehazi is being blamed for, and that is what he's getting punished for, and therefore the way to punishment is that the thing that was cured or gotten rid of in Naaman is going to go into Gehazi. Now, Chazal note, that it's going to be in you and your descendants. But the Radak points out, it doesn't say you and all your descendants, and suggests, therefore, that this punishment was not to every one of his sons. It was to those of his sons who were alive at the time. And then the question of why did they get punished? The answer that's given is because they were there and they witnessed what was going on and did not protest it as they were supposed to, and therefore they get punished. Another example of the assumption in Chazal, an important one to know and a somewhat scary one, they did not, that Chazal assume repeatedly that there's an obligation on eyewitnesses to protest things that are going wrong, and the failure to protest can, at least on some occasions, be counted as equivalent to engaging in the sin itself. So that's what you have here, that it'll be in you, and you think that it happens immediately that Gehazi becomes a mitzvah. He gets a tzarat of Naaman for his failures to observe the strictures that Elisha had placed, and for his failure to support Elisha in making this miracle the height of proof of God's power in the world, that it was meant to be, that it largely was, and that it could have been even more so had Naaman only stuck to the script that had been laid out by Elisha. Have a great day.